The credit of Palestinians, they are clear. They have made their priorities clear for over a century. What October 7th required is massive investment in infrastructure, strategy, financial planning. So I think we can put to bed any notion of the Palestinians as this charity, helpless basket case, and just understand that they are a people with substantial capabilities, just screwed up priorities.
Shalom and welcome to State of the Nation. I'm Israeli government spokesman Alon Levy, here to take you between the lines and beyond the headlines, the bigger stories. It's February 16th, day 133 of the October 7th war. In Gaza, since the start of the war, Hamas has been waging war out of hospitals. Yesterday, the IDF began a precise and limited operation in the Nasser hospital in Khan Yunis, based on credible intelligence that Hamas might be storing the dead bodies of murdered hostages in the hospital. That came after it warned Hamas to stop abusing the hospital in violation of international law, after urging civilians sheltering there to evacuate through IDF-secured humanitarian corridors, and after delivering supplies to make sure the hospital can remain operational. The IDF arrested several Hamas suspects based inside. Shamefully, since the start of the war and before, the Red Cross, the World Health Organization, and other international agencies pressuring Israel to leave Hamas on its feet have said nothing about Hamas fighting out of hospitals. While Israel does everything it can to minimize harm to civilians, Hamas says openly it's ready to sacrifice them as martyrs. So why don't those UN agencies take them at their word? Why don't Western journalists and leaders call them out for it? Why do they tell a completely different story about how Israel is always to blame for everything, while absolving the Palestinians of any responsibility or agency? Why do they keep talking over the Palestinians instead of listening to them? My guest today is the razor-tongued Einat Wilf, who's been calling for outsiders to give the Palestinians the respect of listening to what they actually say, instead of, as she says, Westplaining them. Einat is a former member of Knesset, a writer, speaker, academic, and co-author of the influential book, The War of Return: How Western Indulgence of the Palestinian Dream Has Obstructed the Path to Peace. Full disclosure, the English is my translation of her Hebrew bestseller. Einat joins me here in the State of the Nation studio to talk about Westplaining and how it's aggravating our conflict with the Palestinians. Let's get cracking.
Breaking news out of Israel this morning.
Shocking hostage taking.
Hundreds of Israelis are dead.
I want to bring in Israeli government spokesman.
What happens when the four-day pause?
How do you resolve this?
Where does this go?
You can't
Dr. Einat Wilf, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The 10-7 massacre has transformed all of our lives. How's the war been affecting you?
I've been doing what I did before the war, which is writing and speaking and thinking.
Excellently, I should add.
Thank you. It's very kind. So about Zionism, the Jewish state, the conflict, the path to peace. It's what I've been doing before. I've been doing it more intensively after. But in that sense, the same.
Okay. You have coined or popularized the term Westplaining. Mm-hmm. Now, I could start the podcast by telling our listeners what that means, but then I would be mansplaining. So why don't you tell us what Westplaining is?
So Westplaining is a term I invented as I was writing the book, The War of Return. And like mansplaining, it has the same attitude of explaining what someone else said perfectly clearly.
And in this case, it is the West explaining what
Palestinians have very clearly said. So it's when Western diplomats and journalists explain away what Palestinians have just said. So Palestinians will clearly say, from the river to the sea, we don't want two states, only one.
And the West doesn't hear it that way. They explain it otherwise.
Exactly. They'll explain that they are just expressing anger and resentment, or it's about the occupation or the settlements. And there will be lots of explanations. My favorite Westplaining moment, there are many, but my favorite one was a few years ago in a kind of premonition. There were all these marches to the border with Israel within Gaza, never on the border with Egypt, on the border with Israel. And those were called the marches of return.
That was how the Palestinians called them.
Exactly.
Because what did they understand by return?
They understood that one day they will take back, in their view, the state of Israel, the entire territory from the Jordan River. I understand these days you have to say which river and which sea.
Of course, because not everyone understands.
Exactly. So
when they understand, they become more pro-Israel, but they need to understand
interesting.
First.
So from the Jordan River to the sea. And there was a journalist who asked the people who were marching, what are you marching from? A Western journalist. And they all said the same thing. From the river to the sea, this is ours. They show beyond the border. This was stolen from us. We'll take it back. They all say the same things. And then he turns to the camera and he says, they are marching against the dire conditions in Gaza.
Einat, you're reminding me of a podcast, the New York Times podcast recently about what the Houthis want. Mm-hmm. And Michael Barbaro asked the reporter, what do the Houthis want? And she says, well, their slogan is death to America, death to Israel, cursed be the Jews. But what they're really trying to do is to distract people from their own failures of government. Mm-hmm. And I'm tearing my hair out saying, maybe just listen to what they say. And that, I think, is where this West-splaining fits in with the Palestinian arena, that sometimes they're not actually listening with respect to what the Palestinians themselves are saying.
Certainly. One of the things, sometimes I called it almost a neocolonial attitude, because it continues to infantilize the locals, tell them what they're really saying. By the way, it goes many ways, two ways. Israel says, we want peace, we'll do everything for peace, and it'll be like, Israel's not. Doesn't really mean it, and Palestinians want
to They're doing West-splaining to us as well.
Absolutely. And so it's the same attitude that essentially says, we know better, we know what they really mean. And at least with the book, The War of Return, one of the things that I'm very proud of is that it gives the Palestinians the respect of taking them at their word. And I do think that's the most respectful attitude, to take them seriously.
I'm reminded of another example now of a time the BBC interviewed Palestinians who spoke about Al-Yahud.
Yes.
Which is the Jews, and translated it as the Israelis. That's an example of West-splaining?
Absolutely, because, you know, they don't really mean the Jews. They need to be translated. And that's, by the way, one of the things that was very useful with the Houthi slogan, is that they say, death to Israel and cursed be the Jews. So they make it clear that they are capable of using the word Israel or Israelis. But when they say Yahud, they very clearly mean the Jews. But that's too uncomfortable. We don't want to embarrass the Arabs or Palestinians that they really want to slaughter the Jews. So let's translate it to a term that is clearly more palatable to our audience.
Okay, I'm still trying to get my head around West-splaining. So I want to give you a couple of examples of statements made by Palestinian leaders, and I want you to West-splain them to me. And tell
Certainly.
Me how the West understands these statements, and not, as you say, giving them the respect of listening to what they actually say.
Yes.
This is Hassan Asher, the PLO Executive Committee Secretary General, January last year, commenting on what we call the pay-for-slay policy, that the Palestinian Authority pays salaries to terrorists in jails. Mm-hmm. Been very controversial. The US has tried to get it to roll back. Here's what he has to say. I would like to reassure you of our firm and unwavering commitment. Our martyrs, our prisoners and their families is where we cross the line. Even if we have one penny left, it will be spent on the families of the martyrs and prisoners. They are our purest, most permanent, loftiest and most precious jewel, he says, referring to convicted terrorists in Israeli jails, promising they will give them the last penny in the Palestinian Authority budget. What do Western donors to the PA hear when they hear that?
Oh, clearly that they are providing welfare to families in need.
Why?
Because those are families in need.
And that's how they understand?
Yes.
But they've been very clear in black and white.
That is why West-splaining is so powerful.
But this is the glorification of terrorism. It's very, very clear.
Again, as I say, to the credit of Palestinians, they are clear. They have made their priorities clear for over a century. They tell us what they want. They tell us what they're trying to achieve. They tell us what they value. But it's, you know, the implications of coming to terms with what they really want are substantial. It means that the solution is not in getting out of the West Bank or removing territory, removing settlements or ending the occupation. It means that Palestinians are, as a people, are really committed to the fact that there will be no sovereign Jews between the river and the sea. And
okay, let me give you another example.
Okay.
We've been very clear that the day after Hamas, after this war ends, the Gaza Strip cannot be governed by elements that support terrorism. Whoever governs Gaza must be committed to fighting terrorism, not funding it. The soundbite I like to use is they must be routing Hamas, not rooting for Hamas. Now, here we have a Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh, beginning of December, saying, Hamas cannot be eliminated because it exists everywhere and is part of the Palestinian political fabric. Wes, explain that to me.
Hamas doesn't represent the Palestinians. That's my favorite these days.
Go on.
So my favorite West-planning moment these days is the general Hamas doesn't represent the Palestinians.
Which we've heard from many Western leaders.
Oh, yes.
It's not true?
Absolutely. And they, here, they tell you, Hamas represents us. We love them. We love what they
did. And these are their rivals. This is the Fatah party.
This is their rivals. Any notion that in that sense they are moderates and not... They say they are part of us. They are who they are. They represent our deepest ethos, our deepest identity. But the West would like to tell a story that Hamas is a bunch of aliens that took over just a peace-loving strip that was minding its own business.
Even and though the Palestinians themselves in poll after poll are saying, actually, we think the October 7 massacre was legitimate. We think it was justified. We think strategically it was the correct decision. We keep hearing this message that Hamas doesn't represent the Palestinians. What is getting lost in translation here?
Well, that's exactly the nature of Westplaining. Nothing gets lost in translation. Again, to the credit of Palestinians, they're very clear. They make it clear that Hamas represents their deepest desires, their deepest ethos. Hamas is merely the most brutal, successful executor of the Palestinian vision of no Jewish state. They're not some alien element that infiltrated Palestinian society and hijacked it.
And why then do we have that narrative that says the Hamas does not represent the Palestinians? Why would people say that when the Palestinians come along and say, actually, they do?
Yes. So here I have to go from the innocent to the sinister. The innocent explanation is the neocolonial one that Westerners...
That's the innocent explanation. Okay, I want to hear what the sinister one is.
The sinister one is that they actually participate in the same desire and they just want to give it a mask of respectability.
Which, of course, we should state is definitely not the way that our firm allies who have been making that have been said.
Yes, so, but that's where it goes from. And also, I think there's, as the saying with from the river to the sea, all that, there's a desire to run away from the implications. Because if Hamas represents the Palestinians, then the job ahead of us is much, much, much harder than, again, removing the settlements, ending the occupations. Even if those are logistically challenging issues, they're at least simple. If all the Palestinians are is a people seeking freedom, ending the occupation, annoyed by settlements, then the solution is clear. Just finish these things.
But if that's not what is going
exactly,
on
exactly, if they are truly committed, as they have been for the last century, that there will be no sovereign Jews between the river and the sea, then what needs to be done is the very transformation of who they are, their deepest identity, their ideology.
And that's already a much bigger policy challenge.
Massive.
You know, I'm thinking of an example of Westplaining that I had in a BBC interview near the beginning of this war. Want to hear about it?
Of course.
I'm on BBC Newsnight, and I'm the first guest after an interview with PA Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh. He was presented as some kind of moderate, even though three times they ask him, will you condemn the October 7th massacre? And he wriggles out of it. And then he said something interesting. He said, and I quote, the Palestinians have been in struggle, have been fighting in every means and ways for the last 100 years. 100 years, now that's 25 years before the declaration of the State of Israel, long before 1967. And when I started the interview, I said, I want a right of response to Mohammed Shtayyeh. Did you notice he said that they have been waging this war for 100 years? And she said, no, I think he said 56. And I said, no, Kirsty, he said 100. He said 100. Please rewind your own tapes and give your guest the courtesy of listening to what he actually said. What do you think was getting lost in translation that he's saying 100 years and the interviewer is going, I think he said 56?
Again, that nothing gets lost in translation. As you very correctly noted and perfectly responded, He was very clear about what their battle is about.
Very clear. And it's really important that we give our Palestinian neighbors that respect of saying, you know, you're speaking very clearly and we hear you.
Again, but this, you said this was a British interview. Mm. Well, if they acknowledge that it's a 100-year battle, they have to begin to acknowledge their complicity. The fact that they caved in to Arab violence in the 20s and
30s. Do you think all of that is going through the journalist's head when...
No, I don't think in real time it goes through her head, but she understands intuitively, instinctively, that she cannot afford to acknowledge 100 years because the implications are above her pay grade.
In terms of what it means for their own national identity.
For their own national identity, for the pleasure that they have taken for decades now in blaming the Jews for everything.
Well, let me push back a little bit, because when October 7th happened, it was a moment that really tore the mask off. And
yes.
It was clear to everyone what was happening. And I was personally astonished by a statement from the European Commission President,
yes,
Ursula von der Leyen, who said, and this is a really astonishing quote, "These innocents were killed for one single reason, for being Jewish and living in the state of Israel." And it sounds like she listened to Hamas and understood exactly what Hamas was saying and wasn't trying to put lipstick on
no.
the pig there.
And you're right, there was a moment that there was almost a tear in reality, that the horror of it, the brutality...
Suddenly brought everything into focus.
Yes, the intentionality of it. But you know as well as anyone, she's under massive attack for the positions that she took.
And she has really been a very stalwart ally of Israel,
yes,
and has really, to her credit, stuck her neck out and been a very firm friend of the Jewish people.
Yes, and I think what we've seen is in many ways people had to double down. Either people saw what was happening and that's it, they were clear and they're weathering massive attacks, or they had to increase the level of West planing. I think this is why the genocide case is taking place, because they had to...
An absurd blood libel by South Africa that has decided to play advocate for the devil in the soundbite I'm using and act as the legal arm of Hamas.
Precisely. But the whole idea was to ex post facto to justify the horror by essentially saying this is a horror committed against people who are by their nature Nazis. So anything is justified. And I think you're seeing this bifurcation and the West planning is becoming even more extreme.
Let's talk about some West planning in the context of what's been happening since October 7th. The IDF has uncovered a vast tunnel network underneath the Gaza Strip. Really, one of the most, I fudge this word every time, I'll try to say it, megalomaniacal, I think I got it, megalomaniacal building project.
Yeah.
According to the New York Times, might be 1.5 times longer than the London Underground, mm-hmm, or the New York subway. Now that sort of challenges the narrative in the West about the Palestinians being poor and helpless. What are you seeing there?
Absolutely. I've been arguing that October 7th should put an end to any mythology of the poor Palestinians. What October 7th required is massive investment in infrastructure, planning, strategy, financial planning, economic planning, vision, a very perverse kind of vision, but vision.
But a grandiose vision.
Yes. So I think we can put to bed any notion of the Palestinians as this charity, helpless basket case, and just understand that they are a people with substantial capabilities, just screwed up priorities.
Mm.
They are a people...
Gaza's problem has never been resources.
No.
They had resources to build 1.5 London Undergrounds. The problem was priorities, and they prioritized the massacre. Simple as that.
And they have prioritized no Jewish state, anywhere from the river to the sea. They have prioritized turning Gaza literally into a launching pad from which they can liberate and take back the land, ensure that there's no Jewish state. That has been their priority as a people. And Hamas executed that on behalf of their people.
I visited one of the Hamas terror tunnels a few weeks ago. It's an extraordinary experience if you ever get a chance.
I'm sure.
400 meters away from the Erez crossing, this opening that looks like a portal into another world. I'm hearing the Stranger Things theme tune going through my head.
God. Okay.
And it stretches for 4 kilometers into the Gaza Strip. And you look at all that concrete and the ventilation shafts and the electricity and you think, not only how much money and concrete was poured in, money and concrete that the international community was sending in as quote-unquote humanitarian aid, you're really struck by how much engineering talent and creativity went into this project. at the same time that sort of this world, the world was being told this story about the poor, destitute Palestinians who have no choice but to wage violent struggle, yeah, and the sort of atrocities we saw on October 7th. How do you think that maybe moving past October 7th, the world might reevaluate what was going in and what it was doing in all those years?
So I'm not seeing enough of that yet. By now, I can say I have books, essays, lectures, tapings, in which I say, do not give a dollar, do not give a bag of cement to Gaza, as long as the priority of the people of Gaza is not to think of Gaza as their home, but as a launch pad from which to take Palestine from the river to the sea.
And by the way, that is another, I think, interesting example of Westblaining, that,
yes,
when Westerners talk about the quote-unquote occupation, mm-hmm, they're referring to the land that Israel conquered in 1967, the West Bank, mm, Judea, yeah, and Samaria. But when the Palestinians use the word occupation, they mean...
they mean, again, any Jewish sovereignty in any part of the land.
And Westblaining is to say, no, they don't actually mean that.
No, exactly. It's like the Yahud turned Israelis, the occupation only 56 years, even terrorism, the word that you mentioned. When Palestinians speak of terrorism, there's only one kind of terrorism. That's the one that Israel employs. They don't consider...
which any... it does not.
Yeah, from their perspective.
For the record.
Yes. From their perspective, they never exercise terrorism. And this explains why many polls over the decades were saying Palestinians are opposed to terrorism. And we interpreted it the way we wanted to.
Oh, that's interesting.
But they don't they think of it as resistance, as liberation. So they never consider what they're doing terrorism. So when you tell them Gaza has to fight against terrorism, they're like, sure.
No, Inad, it sounds like you're generalizing just a little bit when you say they, as if like it's one big monolithic group and they all have the same opinion.
So that is the comment I get most often. People rebel against this notion of...
I do have to push back, yeah.
I get it. And people do push back. And I always say, look, I have made it so easy to take me down. I have made it so easy to undermine my argument. Go ahead and bring me Palestinians who, in their own voice and publicly, precisely because of Westplaining, I refuse to hear from any Westerner or even Israeli who says, oh, I've heard them say that. It has to be public, it has to be in their own voice, and it has to be specific. It can't be, oh, we just want the violence to end, or we want peace, or this is terrible. They have to say clearly, the Jewish people as a people have the equal right to self-determination in their historical homeland, which is here. We just want to live next to the Jewish state of Israel rather than instead of it.
Which is what the West assumes that they want, and therefore will be willing to sign a final status peace treaty, because that's really what they want and just have to get the right conditions for.
Precisely. A classic Westplaining is two states. When Westerners say two states, they assume one of them is Jewish. When Arabs say two states and you think, oh, they're moderate, they think one Palestinian Arab state in the West Bank and Gaza and another Palestinian Arab state to replace Israel.
Whoa, what do you mean?
So they have this idea called the right of return, which is neither a right nor a return, but they believe it exists, which means that millions of Palestinians, descendants of the original refugees from the 1948 war, believe they have a right that supersedes Israeli sovereignty to settle in Israel. The numbers are such that this is the mechanism by which the Jews become a minority in another Arab-Palestinian state.
Because this is a status of refugee that is inherited down the generations, as opposed to the other UN Commission for Refugee definition that would have negated their refugee status. And so if we look then about Westplaining specifically in the question of the refugee status, mm-hmm, I find that Western diplomats speak of the refugee issue as if, well, this is a bargaining chip, it's a final status issue, and when the day comes, the Palestinians will be willing to... they're making this claim, but they're just chest-thumping, and we'll put this to one side, and we can have a peace treaty. But when the West is saying you are refugees, including 70% of people in Gaza who are classified as refugees and get their health and education services from refugees, and they say they're refugees, they don't mean the same thing, do they? What's not getting lost in translation?
So again, assuming you push aside any sinister interpretations, what is going on is that from the again, from the Arab Palestinian perspective, they're very clear. The perpetuation of this idea of being refugees, they're not refugees. The idea in the West that this is...
And they're not refugees, it's important to state for the record, because...
They're not refugees because they either live in Gaza or the West Bank, have been born there, never been out of there. They're not refugees from Palestine.
Oh, gosh, and here we have another example of West-blaming, which is when the international community says the Palestinian Authority must govern Gaza. And you say, but the Palestinian Authority doesn't even govern the parts of the West Bank that are nominally under its control, the so-called refugee camps, where they say, no, until we sign, until we resolve this conflict, the UN has a responsibility to provide health and welfare services. So why would they provide those services for the 70% of people in Gaza who are considered refugees?
More than that, the Palestinian Authority brings every high-level visitor to a refugee camp.
Really?
And no,
take them to Yad Vashem, and they take them to.
Yeah, and they, Prince William came there, and I remember thinking, does no one ever ask why is the Palestinian Authority and these high-level visitors always write on their visitors that they're visiting Palestine?
Mm.
Very well, you're visiting Palestine. As far as you're concerned, Palestine exists. Do you wonder why the first kind of thing you're visiting is a refugee camp of people who are born in Palestine, never left Palestine, and are refugees from Palestine?
Something doesn't seem to add up.
Yes, and yet no one bothers to ask. But you talked about the idea that this is a bargaining chip. Now, this was a legitimate idea in the 90s, okay? Once the Palestinians will finally get what we thought they wanted, what we West Plain that they wanted, a state, end of the occupation, sovereignty, no settlements, once they'll get that, then they'll forego this crazy idea of a right of return because it's a bargaining chip.
But that is still the Western conception at the moment. Now that we're in the middle of the war and they're talking about needing to have the vision of a two-state solution, they're assuming that that is what the Palestinians still actually want.
But now it's not a legitimate view, because by now we have enough experience to know that at the critical moments in 2000 with Barak, in 2008 with Olmert, when they could have had...
When there were peace negotiations that nearly led to an agreement.
Exactly, and they could have had their own state, no settlements, no occupation, and the price of that was to let the Jewish state be, which means they are not refugees, there is no right of return. They walked away with Abu Mazen saying clearly to Condoleezza Rice, I cannot tell, at the time it was 4 million refugees, that they're not going, he said, home, but essentially settling in Israel.
So look, we can treat this as something amusing. Look how inconsistent all these Western diplomats are, and their positions don't quite add up. But it has real world effects, and we are experiencing that in the flesh now, with the October 7 massacre, with the terrorists who perpetrated that massacre, who are the product of 16 years of Hamas rule. They are the product of UNRWA schools as well, just as those camps. They're not camps. They're neighborhoods with multiple-story concrete buildings. Have always produced terrorists committed to this vision of the violent, they say, liberation, conquest of the state of Israel. How are we, in this war, experiencing West-splaining around that question of refugees, the 70% of people in Gaza who the UN is saying are refugees? What are the real consequences of that?
The consequences of that is that people are discussing the day after and a two-state and all that.
The day after Hamas.
Without understanding, again, that Hamas is merely the product of decades in which the people of Gaza are being legitimized, coddled in the idea that Gaza is not their home. So if anything is ever to change, this is the first thing that must go.
That would be your first advice to Western diplomats who say, we want to build a prosperous, sustainable Gaza the day after the war. What needs to happen? What do we need to be pushing them on for the day after Hamas?
They need to say, as a precondition to anything, a precondition to any aid, any bag of cement, any dollar, any vision, the precondition is that the people of Gaza understand that they are not refugees. It means that UNRWA is no longer active. UNRWA erases from its roster any registration of people living in Gaza and the West Bank as being as refugees from Palestine. They need to understand that they are not refugees. They do not possess a right of return into Israel. Their future is in Gaza. They can build Gaza for themselves, but not for the purpose of destroying the Jewish state. Only when the people of Gaza, substantially, all of them, say clearly, this is who we are. We understand that we are not refugees. We do not possess a right of return. We want to live next to the Jewish state of Israel and not instead of it. Then flood them with aid, but not a minute before.
But until then, I mean, who is going, do you imagine the day after Hamas taking responsibility for the welfare needs of the people on the ground who do need to be fed and have water? And
so let's go back to October 7th. Required skill, ability, investment, and it's just a matter of priorities. We keep infantilizing the Palestinians and Hamas. We keep letting them off the hook.
What do you mean infantilizing them?
Tomorrow morning, Hamas can end all of this, release the hostages, surrender, disarm, abnegate the from the river to the sea
ideology.
And
that is exactly what the whole world should be calling, and our American allies have been very clear. Secretary Blinken says, I think, at nearly every press conference, guys, this war can end tomorrow if Hamas surrenders.
So they're responsible.
Right.
And they're responsible, and they have a border with Egypt, and they have tunnels under the border of Egypt from which they have supplied arms. They can supply their people. The notion that Hamas can be released to do the work of battling Israel and everyone else has to take care of the population. And that goes again to the idea that Hamas doesn't represent the population. It represents them. It's responsible for them. It should be held responsible for them.
Interesting. How else do you think within this war at the moment we're seeing Westplaining in action in the Gaza Strip? What are the Palestinians saying that the West is not hearing?
I think we pretty much discussed all of it. They're saying that they're very proud of October 7th. They're saying that the Jewish day, by the way, I heard someone recently say that it's time to plan for the day after the Jewish state.
That's, who said that?
One of, I don't know, someone Arab or Muslim, I don't know, but one on that side. And I thought, yeah, that's their vision. Their vision is if they're, what I love is that who's planning for the day after? Israelis, Westerners, think tanks, everyone busy planning for the day after. Can we finally stop trying to want for the Palestinians what they don't want for themselves? We can't force them to want for themselves what they've never wanted for themselves. They want to plan for the day after Israel. That's what they're thinking is happening.
And essentially you're saying through Westplaining, the world has been indulging those dreams of the violent destruction of Israel.
All the time.
In a sentence, if we're trying to say to the world, grab these diplomats by the shoulders, shake them and say, please just listen to what they are saying. In a sentence, what are they saying?
The Jewish state is an unacceptable existence anywhere between the river and the sea. We will not rest. We will not accept this. As far as we're concerned, this is a humiliating aberration. If we have to wait it out, one generation, five generations, ultimately this Jewish experiment in sovereignty in the land will end sooner or later. We just need to wait them out.
Which on the one hand is what we're hearing from certain radical elements on university campuses and streets in the West. But on the other hand, I understand the cognitive dissonance that if you accept that what the Palestinians are saying is literally what they mean, that upends decades of foreign policy and experience. And I want to end with a quick quiz.
Sure.
I really like the word Westplaining. I have a little spelling bee for you, a few other conflict-related neologisms. Tell me what you think they mean, okay? Gaza lighting.
essentially, I don't know, the people of Gaza, Hamas, talking about what's happening in Gaza as if they have no responsibility. I don't know.
Well, where do you think it comes from, Gaza lighting?
From gaslighting.
From gaslighting, which is when you try to make someone doubt their own sanity or humanity.
Yeah.
So yes, so Gaza lighting, when the Palestinians are trying to make people doubt what they see with their own eyes. Those atrocities didn't happen, right? Okay.
Yes.
Proper Gaza.
Again, it's the years and decades of propaganda, I'm assuming it's coming from that Gaza is this miserable place, open-ended prison, you know, all
which, by the way, before October 7th, the narrative we heard from the Palestinians was that Gaza was an open-air prison. Since then, we're hearing it was apparently paradise on earth.
Exactly. And I know you had Shani Moore to talk about it. And it's something that we saw. This is actually the whole Palestinianism comes from. When in the UNRWA schools, you begin to have the Palestinian national ethos built on the idea of revenge and return, you have a generation that is born after 1948. They've never lived here. They are raised on the story of a paradise lost of Palestine that was stolen from them by evil white European colonialist crusaders. So this idea of mythologizing the past but never assuming responsibility, it's a pattern.
And in that final one, and this connects to the work of my counterparts in Hamas, the Hamas spokespeople, who I think are not being interviewed enough because every time they go on TV, they stick such a massive foot in their mouths by telling the world what they actually think, that they make my case for Israel better than I ever could. The word is Hamas bara.
You just defined it. It's when Hamas goes, even though recently they're actually trying to be smarter about it, they issued this notion that they have nothing against Jews, only Zionists.
Very convincing difference.
Yes, I think they're beginning to catch on how to speak to the
West. They don't hate
Jews,
they only hate Jews who stand up for themselves.
Precisely.
Einad Wolf, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode of the State of a Nation podcast. Please join us on YouTube, subscribe, or on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll be back soon with more about the state of our nation. Thank you.